Hello and welcome to the FAIR Digital Finance Forum session today on open finance, where we'll be talking about how we can unlock innovation and empower consumers. And today is part of the theme for the conference that digital finance is data protected and private. So I just want to welcome you today and say thank you very much for coming. We have a chat function and a Q&A function, so please add your questions there for the panel. We would be delighted to take your questions. We've got some amazing speakers today and just want to thank them for coming along. Some of them are not feeling too well. Some of them are up very early and some of them are dealing with hotter than usual weather. So just to say thank you to our panelists. But do use the chat box, introduce who you are, which organisation you're from, and where you're joining from, and we would love to hear your questions as well. So just in terms of an introduction for me, I'm Faith Reynolds. I am a strategic advisor to government, industry and the not-for-profit sector. I have a bit of a portfolio career and I typically focus on consumer issues, financial services, technology and regulation. So as part of my role until May last year, I was the independent consumer representative at the Open Banking Implementation Entity. So I have followed the journey through open banking quite closely and know the variations of APIs and technology perhaps a little bit more than I might have envisaged at the beginning of that process. I now do a number of non-exec roles. So I'm on the Payment Systems Regulator Board. I am a non-exec for the current account switch service, which helps people switch their current accounts. And I'm also a non-executive director for Fair for All Finance, which is an organisation that uses dormant assets, so money that companies haven't been able to reconnect with their owners, and uses that to promote financial inclusion by helping scale up and grow the affordable affordable credit sector. So, but that's enough about me. What we really want to hear about is open finance and what this session is about. What is it and why does it matter? Well, for those of you who are new to the subject, open finance allows a consumer to give permission to third parties like fintechs to access their account so that those fintechs can provide innovative and useful services. People and small businesses can give their consent to a third party to access their data or make a payment or other transaction on their behalf. It sounds a bit scary to give somebody or give a fintech access to your account, but there are controls around that. So imagine if you are applying for a mortgage or for credit, you might be asked to prove that you can repay the loan. You might be asked for proof of income. You might be asked, for instance, to send in 3 months bank statements. I'm currently remortgaging and I have been asked to send 3 months bank statements. Well, open finance simplifies that. So with open banking, you could simply give my consent to a fintech to access that data directly from the bank on my behalf, and then to share that with the provider or to use it themselves as the credit provider. So it's simple and it's secure and it's convenient. So it kind of can make things a bit slicker, a bit more convenient. So why still does that matter? Where I've not really heard about open banking, I've not seen it on the streets, my banks aren't talking about it. What is it? Well, it's a growing phenomenon and very much associated with the development of fintech, increasing innovation and competition through access to data. In some countries like Mexico, it's seen as a driver of financial inclusion. There are around 60 countries worldwide who are involved in open banking initiatives, and they're just popping up everywhere. So Australia, China, India, the US, Bahrain, Nigeria, Italy, Brazil, UK, and so on. There are lots of countries currently looking at how do they deliver open banking, which is a shortened term for transaction data from your current account or your bank account, or open finance, which is kind of like, okay, well, I could take data from my credit account or my mortgage account or my pensions account and share that, or kind of some call it open life or smart data, where actually you could also take data from other spaces like energy sector. So in Australia, they've started with energy. How can I share my energy data How can that be used by other organisations to help create cheaper bills for me? Or how could it be used by organisations to plan and look at how they can develop low carbon technology and retrofit housing associations with? So it's all about how do we open up data and how do we use that both for social good and for private gain? So APIs, application programming interfaces, are the technology that underpin how fintechs interact with the bank or other financial institution that the consumer has an account with. And the design of those APIs is crucial in ensuring that data can be protected and private. In some countries like Brazil and Australia, initiatives have been led by regulation. And that might mean that there are particular API standards, security profiles that companies should be adhering to. In the UK, it means that fintechs have to be registered with the regulator and that banks have to, whether they want to, provide APIs. Most use the UK Open Banking Standard, which levels the playing field for fintechs because they can more easily integrate with multiple banks. So this concept of standards can be quite helpful in developing a competitive framework. The regulation that we have in the UK and the standard also mean that there's no need for the fintech to create a contract with the bank to access the consumer's data. So as long as I consent, the bank is duty bound to provide that data to the fintech. But that's not the same everywhere. And there are variations on this. So in some countries like the US, they've been doing this stuff for years and it's been industry led and the industry is right at the forefront. But it's been built around contracts. There has to be some way to govern that relationship of data sharing. So contracts between a fintech and a bank. But it sounds a bit complicated. What does it mean for the consumer? When it's delivered well, open finance is a fantastic opportunity for creating more personalized, convenient, and financially inclusive services. It's about the data. Here in the UK, a couple of years ago, I wrote a report with colleagues at the Open Banking Implementation Entity. And we conservatively estimated that open banking could be worth as much as 18 billion a year for consumers, not for firms, but for consumers. How much value could they get from open banking? And the financial value that they could get came from fintechs helping people to reduce their household costs. And obviously that's become even more pertinent today as we look at the rise in cost of living standards. It also comes from helping people access credit at a reduced cost, perhaps helping people access credit for the first time to smooth income. Also helping people develop financial cushions through saving or getting better returns on their savings. So open banking can be used to help automate micro savings into another account. But we also found it's not just the financial value that open banking can help with, but also financial health and well-being. And that's really important here because with data, fintechs and other institutions can provide services which are much more personalized, which look at removing barriers to products like credit, but also kind of help personalize products so that they can prompt people to get advice, perhaps to stop people getting into over-indebtedness. They can prompt people to get advice earlier, or even in the case where people have money, but aren't using it, how can they get better returns on that? It can give people greater visibility over their finances and greater control. So lots of stuff to talk about. Open finance offers lots of opportunity, but how do we do that? How do we unlock it safely and securely? So we have a brilliant panel lined up. And so I'm just going to come out to the panel and just ask you to introduce yourselves. So I think, Arushi, if I start with you, would you just like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Faith, for having me. It's wonderful to be here. Well, I'm Arushi Goel, and I lead data policy and blockchain initiatives at the World Economic Forum. I'm a lawyer by profession. Well, at the forum on the data policy side, I'm currently engaged in a global initiative, which is Data for Common Purposes, where our key focus is to enable data sharing between public and private sector for common good. On the blockchain side, I'm currently leading our regulatory work stream for a digital currency governance consortium, which is a consortium of almost 85 organizations across the world, where we are exploring the transformation of our global financial systems due to the emergence of digital currencies.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Rishi. Duncan, do you want to go next?
Sure. Again, thanks, Cathleith, for having me today. It's great to be here. My name is Duncan Coburn. I'm the founder and CEO of OneBanks. I'm sure many of you haven't heard of OneBanks. It's a fintech organization based in Scotland, in the UK, and we've been built to drive financial inclusion. I'm passionate about financial inclusion and how we can use technology to help people's lives, and open finance, open data, open banking is a great ways to do that. And what OneBanks does is brings that to life. OneBanks is a shared infrastructure bank branch. So we bring together all of the services from your underlying bank and provide that in a single location. So instead of having to go in different directions to do your everyday banking, you can have it all in a convenient location using the latest technology. So that's what OneBanks is, and I'll come on to explain it in a wee bit more detail shortly.
That's great. Thank you, Duncan. Benny, do you want to just introduce yourself?
Thanks, Faith. Hi, everybody. Very nice to be here. I'm Beni Choke. I head the Future of Finance Initiative at Dwara Research. My day job gives me an opportunity to understand the barriers that low-income users face in interfacing with digital finance or digital social protection. So really, my task is to understand customer protection risks that come from digitization of finance and how might providers solve for them. Very excited to be here. Thanks.
And Justin.
Hey, thanks. I'm Justin Brooklyn. Thanks for inviting me to the forum. I'm here on behalf of Consumer Reports. We're an 85-year-old consumer advocacy organization here in the United States. I head up our work on technology policy, so do a lot of work on competition issues, broadband support, algorithmic bias and platform accountability, and then privacy, which is what I'm going to be mostly talking about here today, where we try to enact privacy legislation here in the United States. We put pressure on companies to do a better job protecting people's personal information, pushing regulators to be more protective with the existing laws that we have right now. So thanks for inviting me, and looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Justin. And just to say thank you to those of you who've joined us. I can see Roxana and Kamal and Shah, another Kamal and Kimera and Glenn and Matt obviously with us as well. So thank you guys for sharing your names and your organisations in the chat. It's great to have you with us. It'd be great, Arushi, if you could perhaps get us started. I've elaborated a little bit on the opportunities of open finance for empowering consumers, but can you tell us a bit more about why open finance is so important, and really why our audience should be paying attention to it today?
Sure. Thank you, Faith, for the question. As you mentioned, open finance has this potential to transform the way we access and use our financial services. Fundamentally, it's based on a principle that as a consumer, the data is owned and controlled by me and can be reused only with my explicit consent. In fact, you mentioned a number, about 18 billion is what you mentioned as a value for the consumer. Well, purely in economic terms, there are estimates that open financial data could impact economies such as the UK, the US, or even the European Union by almost 1 to 1.5% of GDP. And for India, in fact, the estimation is even higher, which is about 4 to 5% of GDP. Purely from a social lens, open finance would enable financial inclusion, especially for the unbanked and the underbanked population. A lot more choices for the consumers, and as a result, a lot of innovation that comes into the ecosystem. I think what's really valuable within open finance is that data from multiple touch points, not just the banking data, even your insurance, investments, utility data, or even cryptocurrency transactions, they could all be shared in a trusted manner to provide customized, tailor-made solutions for one's financial needs. Let me just cite an example here. So at the forum, we are currently working with a state government in India to pilot a data exchange in the agriculture sector. Now, one of the key use cases that we are focused on is smart credit. Why we are doing that? Well, access to institutional credit is quite a challenge for farmers. One of the reasons is unavailability of information, which can help a financial institution to manage its risk in providing appropriate financing. However, if there's a data exchange where various public and private sector entities that hold a farmer's data, and this data could be anything, right? It could be soil health, crop yield, consumption of agriculture inputs, even something like electronic warehousing receipts. All of this data, if this can be shared with explicit consent of the farmer, this could be used to assess creditworthiness of the farmer, and therefore it will just unlock a lot of financial opportunities that were earlier not available. Similarly, open financial data could benefit small businesses in accessing financing services, even where robust banking data may just not be available. So seeing the way open finance could create environmental, social, or economic benefits, I believe it's safe to say that we start to need paying attention to open finance.
That's brilliant, Arushi. I think I was looking recently in, at some initiatives in Latin America, and I think in Brazil there's a similar kind of initiative looking not at such a public, you know, data exchange, but at least a fintech that's looking at how can we gather data to help provide microcredit into the agricultural sector. So really very important in different countries. Duncan, can you just tell us a bit about how OneBanks and how it works and how you're using it to help empower consumers?
Sure, absolutely. So as I said, OneBanks was started really to drive the use case of open banking and try and involve everybody. Because one thing that frustrated me is, as you said, people can't see it in the high street. The banks aren't always talking about it. So what is it and how can everybody get involved in it? So what we did is bring it to life and have that physical representation that people can go to and get involved with. A lot of people still like doing their banking in person, and therefore having somewhere convenient that they can go and to speak to and understand more about open banking helps with that engagement. So how OneBanks uses open banking is somebody can come to a OneBanks kiosk. They can speak to somebody and they can view the different accounts, balances and transactions. So they can share their consent for OneBanks to view their accounts, data, balances and initiate payments as well. So we can enable withdrawals and withdrawal cash. We can enable deposits through them sharing their account information for us to facilitate a deposit, but also simply just viewing the accounts, balances and transactions, and also that educational experience that I think is really important, combining a new technology with that trust that in-person experience gives you. So 10% of our customers over the last 2 years never had online banking before signing up to OneBanks, which shows that actually having that in-person experience really helps drive that adoption with open banking. And fundamentally what open banking does, it decentralizes the relationship with the customer. So instead of the bank always being the face of the customer, open banking allows third parties and fintechs to be the face of the customer, which I think is incredibly powerful. And as you said, it unlocks opportunities for innovation and for fintechs to actually drive better customer experiences. And while a lot of people are thinking about that from a digital perspective, it's just as important to think about that from a physical perspective as well, because people still like that face-to-face interaction. How can you use open banking where people always go to a high street branch? Actually, you don't need to go to that branch anymore. You can go to a shared infrastructure branch where you can do all of your banking irrespective of who you bank with in that one single location. So what's really exciting is this is a solution which not only is good for the banks because it reduces their costs, but it also, as I said, it really empowers customers because it helps drive that engagement with open banking. And as we continue to develop, I'm excited about how we'll progress with open finance and open data to continue to add to our services, to continue to support customers as best as possible, and continue to drive engagement with people who wouldn't otherwise be involved with open banking. So ultimately, going back to the initial question is, what is OneBanks? OneBanks is a technology platform. And what's exciting is we can deploy that in any setting. It can be a full bank branch, it can be a kiosk setting, it can be big, small, completely dependent on what the community needs and that service requirement of the community. Using open banking and the latest technology allows us to make changes dependent on what the community want. And I think that is really exciting as we continue to use open banking to empower people.
I think you're right, Duncan. It is, and just here in the UK, for those of you that are perhaps less familiar with the context, we are seeing lots of banks shutting branches, which means that people who rely on access to cash or who just don't have kind of digital reception where they are, it's really hard for them to kind of like transact in the way that they want to. And I think just this week we saw HSBC close another 69 branches in the UK. So I think it is important that we think about sort of, you know, how can we use technology and how can we bridge that digital divide? So Benny, I want to come to you next. Hopefully you can still hear me.
Sorry, Faith, was there a question for me?
Ah, yes, there was. Good. I'm sorry that you all froze and I lost you for a moment. Sorry, it was the reception. But Benny, yeah, it'd be great if I do have a question for you. In terms of, you know, how it's shaping up in India, can you tell us a bit about how well it's working there?
Yeah, I think it's a little too early to comment on how well it's working, but I can kind of paint the landscape of how we are approaching open finance. Can I get a quick sound check? Some of you are frozen for me. I'm not sure if I'm audible. Great, thank you.
I can hear you. I'm in and out a bit, but I can hear you.
So I think in India, we've taken three approaches towards open banking, and of them, the most significant one is perhaps the account aggregator system. For those of us who might not really know what account aggregator is, it's a very bespoke Indian version. It's a crossover between consent manager and open banking in some sense. So what an account aggregator does is it is really an institution, and the RBI is giving out licenses. The Central Bank of India is giving out licenses for that institution. And what the account aggregator does is it allows for exchange of information between, let's call them requesters of financial information, and the institutions that have that information, so providers of that information. And all of this happens with the consent of the consumer. So in some sense, they've brought in the idea of open banking, but have retained the control very much with the consumer, in that the consumer has to actively consent to that transfer of data. So that's a very interesting concept. I think the licenses have been around, or at least the framework has been around for 5 years, but account aggregators went live, a couple of them only September last year. So it's still too early for us to say how effective that has been, but some of the things, obviously, to just echo what the rest of you have been saying, is it is a massive opportunity. It obviously improves the competition amongst financial service providers, because now relationship banking is no longer a correlation of how long you have banked with a particular institution. It's that much more fungible and that much more shareable across providers. And of course, this whole new opportunity that comes with fintech providers coming into the fray. And I think fintech in India holds a massive promise. It does everywhere in the world, but especially in India, because we do understand that even though the problem of access to financial services in India has been solved, which is to say that we've made great kind of strides in making a bank account available to the lower income segment through our policy initiatives of the central government, we do see that access has not really converted into usage. So what that means is, even though everybody does have access, most accounts tend to lay dormant. They're on the verge of inactivity. Transactions in the last year are few to name, if at all. And what that means is that bank account is not really acting as a gateway to that relationship banking that can then open pathways to other financial services. And there fintech becomes very important, because like we all agree, they have this kind of ability to infer financial information from seemingly less financial information, or just, you know, personal behavior and a lot of other indicators. providers. And that's very helpful from our network. For instance, we know that some fintech providers, their portfolio is as much as 33% new to bank. So the first ping in the credit bureau is actually by the fintech provider. So it shows the ability of fintech to reach the underserved, the new to banking, and provide financial services. And to that extent, sharing of information would only improve the possibility or the probability of people accessing finance. But again, these are very early days for us to actually be commenting on where it's working and what is it that we need to get better at.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And Benny, I just wanted to follow up because I think, I'm sorry, because I've been a bit in and out, so I haven't been able to hear everything you said. But I know when we talked previously, and we were looking at this subject, we talked about sort of the fact that people are also sharing government to access social protection. And I just wondered how well is that working for consumers? Is that working kind of positively, or how do you, where are some of the challenges?
So I think in India, we are very much, we are at the stage where we are digitizing social protection almost on scale. And what I mean by that is across the different states in the country, there is a move to create a digital registry or a digital database, and that has a lot of information that is relevant for the government. So the government would use this database to actually identify who are the beneficiaries, who is eligible for an entitlement. So for instance, if you are a widower, if you're a member of the unorganized group. So there's a wide range of information that goes in at the family level, because there are several social protection schemes that look to address different kinds of vulnerabilities of employment, vulnerabilities of health, or just your social status. You're coming from a lower caste, or you're coming from a kind of underprivileged background. So those kinds of things. And so their data sharing is happening very much at the state level, and it's a government to citizen contract. It is not so much a consumer lens that a person is wearing, but it's very much a state contract, to say that the citizen and government contract. What is interesting there, which also came up in Arushi's talk, is that database itself provides a lot of opportunity for financial service providers to provide customized credit. So for instance, if we have a database for agriculture or farmers in the country, and one such database is actually in the making, then what that would do is people would be able to see seasonality of crops, cyclicality of crops, yield, all of that. And they would be able to provide better credit to the farmer. And I think that's where it gets really interesting, because there is a lot of value that can be added, but that also shifts the narrative from it being a state citizen contract to a very much a market-based contract between a customer and a potential financial service provider. And I think there we have to be a bit more careful about how the same database is being made available, if it can actually be made available, and what are the extra safeguards that you need to deploy when a private financial service provider is interfacing with the database that was initially collected by the government. And I'm sure Arushi has a lot of thoughts on this, and we'll get to it in the other part of the talk.
Thanks so much, Benny. And that's fascinating, isn't it? So what starts out as consumers sharing their data with a government for sort of particular service, actually the purpose of that data seems to change, and then it can be shared with other institutions. I mean, Justin, this is obviously in your ballpark. I mean, people are, in this situation, people are sharing their data with third parties, sometimes to access vital services. How secure and private is open banking? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think, my concern is there's not always a lot of legal protections around this data once it's shared. So certainly in the United States, where I am, not a lot of privacy regulation, not a lot of privacy rules. There are some rules for traditional financial institutions, but those often don't apply at all to some of these new startups, which gives them more flexibility, but it also means that they're relatively unconstrained with what they can do with your data once they have it in the first place. So federally, not a lot of legislation. At the state level, we're starting to see more laws passed, but again, they tend to be fairly weak. They put a lot of the burden on the consumer to figure out what's going on. So the default privacy rule in the United States is like, don't lie, right? So don't deceive people, right? And that's good. We should not be deceiving people. But that often means that on privacy, the companies just don't say what they're doing. And so if you actually do try to parse through a privacy policy or go through the disclosures and try to figure out what's going on, is written by lawyers, is really evasive, is they reserve broad rights, they don't really disclose exactly what they're doing. So it's actually really hard for consumers to evaluate what's going on. So we actually, at Consumer Reports, we actually looked at five different fintech apps, tried to get a sense of what they're doing, read through all their disclosures, you know, and this is like, this took us like several weeks to try to dig through and find out what was going on. And at the end, and even after all this time, we did not have a great sense of what was happening. We looked at the data disclosures coming up off of our device. We could see that there's a lot of sharing going on with third parties, you know, big companies like Google and Facebook. Maybe that's okay. Maybe it's just being done for analytics. Maybe it's done for other purposes. The problem is there's just not a lot of information about what's going on, and it's really hard for consumers to evaluate it. One more thing, I think we've heard a lot about consent, right? This is all done with consumers' consent. And some jurisdictions do require more in the way of consent, but, you know, consent, I think, can often be illusory. Like, you know, you click OK, what have you agreed to, right? When you go to a website, you must click OK to proceed. And then you click OK, what have you granted? What rights have you granted? Or you click OK to a 30-page license agreement. No one has the bandwidth to try to read through all that to try to figure out what's going on. And so I think, you know, I think I worry about relying too much on consent, because again, the entities, the consumers aren't determining the terms of consent. It's the companies, and consumers often just don't have a great sense of what's going on.
Yeah, and that's one of the real challenges, isn't it? So I've got a question from the chat, which kind of relates a little bit to your area of expertise. It's actually, sorry, in the Q&A, but it's talking about, we've got all this challenge of kind of like privacy and consent, but on the security side, how do we protect open banking from becoming kind of new gateway for scams and fraud, which sort of seems to be growing everywhere? So this is from Shah Taylor, and Shah's also just put your report that you mentioned into the chat as well. And I'm just sort of interested in this question, because we have people consenting to stuff that they're not quite sure what they're consenting to. And obviously, this means that bad actors can also then potentially get access to information. We see more scams and fraud. What's your thought on how do we address this?
Yeah, so on the security side, I think we do, at least in the United States, which is my experience, there are security laws, and companies that have access to data are required to use reasonable security to safeguard it. I think the problem is it's just under-enforced. We tend to under-resource regulators that, and even like when there are a bunch of traditional banks, it's hard enough to stay on top of them. When there are thousands and thousands of apps, who's going to do like kicking the tires to make sure that they all use, reasonable security to protect your data? And then that's against, companies who are trying to do the right thing, just maybe aren't investing enough resources in security. And then there is the fraud aspect too, right? And that when there are more and more startups, which again, is good for competition and can offer new and innovative services for consumers, there are more potentials for bad actors too, right? There are people who can pop up and it's a scheme for identity theft. And they're sharing with more and more third-party partners too. Again, innovation, there's good things around it, but it also increases risk as well. And again, for consumers, they see this service advertised and it seems great. It's really challenging to evaluate. So again, entities like Consumer Reports, we try to rate services, try to say, here are the ones that are trustworthy, here are the ones who have better policies and whatnot. And that's great. But consumers don't have access to that kind of evaluation for every service. And so it can be confusing for folks who are trying to figure out, which of these entities are trustworthy or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it feels like an area where there is an opportunity, isn't there, for consumer organizations to think about sort of practical steps they can take to help consumers manage some of this sort of this marketplace. And I know we've got another question in the Q&A, which I'll come back to later because it fits in with some of our later discussion. So I'll bring you in later then, it's an anonymous person. So I'll bring you in later then. Duncan, just to kind of go back on this sort of thing about what do you think is really needed? Where should we be pushing regulators and governments to do more?
I think it's within the authentication piece. I know we've spoken a lot about the consent and how easy the consent is, which potentially opens up risk. But I think it's within the authentication piece that currently is at risk of excluding a lot of people. In the UK at the moment, the authentication is limited to people who have online banking. And actually, the UK is one of the only places in the EU without a standard identity form. And actually, I think open banking is one of the biggest success stories of a federated identity, whereby someone can prove their identity using an existing bank account that they've got, which is absolutely phenomenal and I think is really exciting and opens up a huge amount of innovation. However, it does limit it to people who already have online banking. And I think there is a huge amount of untapped potential with open banking. And that could be in the form of thinking about how we can merge digital with physical. As I said, that's what One Banks is all about, is bringing that digital technology to life. And actually, if you think about that from an authentication and even consent perspective as well, could you introduce a verbal consent? If somebody doesn't have an iPhone and doesn't have internet, for example, should they be excluded from these benefits that open banking and open finance have? No. And therefore, I think there is more that can be done to push open banking and these consent and authentication towards verbal consent or even chip and pin consent as well. A lot of people still have a bank card. In the UK, there's 20% of people who have got a bank account but don't have online banking. And that is a huge amount of the population that is excluded from making the most of open banking. So I think there's a lot more that can be done there. However, I would stress that the UK has been a good example of implementation of open banking, largely because of the open banking implementation entity and the common standards and the level playing field that's created, which improves accessibility for smaller purpose-based fintechs like One Banks, and also helps consumers with the trust and familiarity of open banking entities. Fintechs, because the experience is consistent, which I think has been important as well.
And Justin, just sort of reflecting on the question you just answered in terms of sort of like thinking about security and also sort of what the laws are. I mean, do you think more's needed from kind of regulators and government to help people, you know, be able to unlock their data more securely? And what kind of duty should there be for firms? What regulations might there be that could just help, reduce some of this complexity that people are facing?
Yeah, so I think, rather than relying overly on consent, people should certainly, data should only be shared with people's, at people's direction and with their consent. But I think there should just be more outright prohibitions on a lot of adversarial practices, right? And think, traditionally consumer groups always wanted opt-in, like only, opt-in for everything. Consumers can consent for everything. But like I said, there's a lot of problems with the consent framework. And so I think you're increasingly seeing legislation aimed at just actually directly reining in bad practices. So there's been a lot of effort in the United States and in Europe as well to ban surveillance advertising. So the sharing of your data for targeted ads. And it's not framed as like opt-in to surveillance advertising. It's like, let's just shut it down altogether. Traditionally, banks had fiduciary obligations to kind of act on behalf of the user. And so maybe extending those sort of fiduciary-like obligations to some of these new fintech startups too, that there are terms of there's the price you pay, but then after that, the app is working on your behalf. Certainly limiting a lot of the sharing, sharing the data with third parties who you haven't told it to, I think is something that should be maybe reined in more directly so that consumers can have more trust around it. That's certainly been the thrust of a lot of the anxiety about a lot of these apps that we've looked at.
Thanks, Justin. We've got a couple of questions in the chat, so I'll come to the second one and I'll come back to the first one. But it says that data protection is not well regulated, mostly in developing countries, that in many cases do not have a general data protection legislation or data protection authority. So what are the ideas panelists have about protecting consumer data and ensuring its appropriate, informed and transparent management to ensure consumer trust in open banking and in digital financial services generally? I was just thinking, Arushi, is this something that you got some thoughts about and some ideas about how we can improve and help consumers manage their consent and their data?
Well, what we've been working with a lot of tech companies, One Bank is here, and so a lot of tech companies are coming up with solutions that embed some of these principles or regulations, where regulations don't exist, at least on a principle level, or otherwise regulation itself, it's embedded in the very tech stack. So so that, you know, as a consumer, I don't need to go read all the terms and conditions on a website, or I don't want to read all the privacy policies that I come across. So I think just that user interface that has to be really simple of how we interact with technology, and that could in a way, take care of the situation where these kind of regulations do not exist at this point. So that kind of innovation, we are seeing that happening a lot in different parts of the world.
Yeah, I think it is that concept. And one of the exciting things, I think, for somebody who's been involved in consumer protection, one of the exciting things is being able to build restrictions into the technology. So it doesn't always have to depend on a regulator going around and checking, but the technology itself can put in some constraints. And Benny, do you have sort of some ideas on this as well?
Yeah, very interesting conversation, actually. And I do think that it's unfortunate. India is one of those countries where we do not have a general data protection regulation thus far. We've been at it for a couple of years, but it's still in the coming. But in the meanwhile, digital financial services need to expand for the various reasons, for the various benefits that they bring to the people. And I think the way we reconcile that vacuum, and that's one step that the regulator in India is trying to take, the central bank. What they're trying to do is they're trying to create self-regulatory organizations. I think it's pretty much true of regulators across the world that they do not have as much capacity as they would need to do a full enforcement and a full supervisory kind of a job. So they all operate in a capacity deficit in some sense. And what the Reserve Bank of India is trying to do is create industry bodies, which are SROs, self-regulatory organizations, and then they are responsible for codes of conduct and for compliance to that conduct of the members that subscribe to the SRO. We've done this in the past in the microfinance industry as well. And right now, the recommendation on the table appears to be that there is an SRO, which then regulates anybody who is involved in ancillary credit services. So the core credit service is taking the credit risk on your balance sheet and lending. But there's a lot that needs to happen when you get to that stage of lending, right? There is origination, there's underwriting, post-lending, there is recollection. So all of those are categorized as ancillary services. And can these ancillary service providers, which are typically fintech providers, come together in an SRO and then have their own code of conduct? And that code of conduct then goes across several aspects, right? There's data protection, there's data security, there's standards for consent. And like Justin mentioned, actually the Indian regulators' imagination is pretty much having fiduciary obligations on that ancillary service provider to make sure that they're acting in the best interest of the consumer. Now, all of that is great on paper, but we do know that the interests of the consumer and the provider might not always reconcile, right? I mean, data becomes a liability only after it has been leaked. Until then, there is absolutely no price that the organization needs to pay with falling costs of data collection, falling costs of data storage. I mean, the cost of collecting additional data is minimal, unless, of course, it's leaked and it can be traced back to you. Both of those are quite hard, right? I mean, it's not very easy to identify when there was a data leak, that's one. And after data has been leaked, it's impossible for a consumer to say, X organization leaked my data, right? And that kind of dynamics means that there are actually no real controls on what organizations collect. And that is problematic because I think that we have to be very careful that there are certain non-negotiables, even in the name of inclusion and even in the name of social protection. So people have strict privacy preferences and they would rather not share some kinds of data. And I think it's important for us to be mindful of that. And having SROs is great, but also having a very granular understanding of the privacy preferences at the last mile is very important. So I think what the government needs is clever ways of regulating, be it RegTech, be it delegated regulation to SROs, et cetera. But what we also need is a greater understanding among providers themselves that what data is necessary and what data is not, and then kind of arriving at an understanding and hopefully abiding by it.
Thanks, Benny. I think it's really interesting, isn't it? Looking at what we do on paper versus what happens in practice. I know this conundrum. But and Duncan, I just wonder if you could be very briefly just mention consent dashboards and perhaps how those work in the UK to help people control their data.
consent dashboards. So yes, the ability for a consumer to be able to withdraw consent at any point of time, I think, is really important, because it gives that ability, again, for the consumer to always be in control of the data, such that if they do change their mind further down the line, they can withdraw that consent, and they have the right to understand how the data has been used. And I think that's working really well in the UK, and is a good way for the consumer to always be on top of the data.
It's a practical, it's just a practical tool, isn't it? That when you've given consent, actually being able to go somewhere within your bank or within your the kind of TPP to be able to see, oh, this is data that I'm handing over, this is what I'm giving. It's quite a useful tool. We've got a couple of other questions. So Justin, I'm going to come to you next on a question, which is it's interesting, Rennie, just listening to you about how data gets moved and transferred through data chains and the liability. Even in the UK, we've still got some challenges about where does data end up. And one of the places that it can end up is in kind of like the hands of marketeers. So just thinking about this question about how do we define surveillance advertising, Justin? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have been more clear about that in the first place. So yeah, so traditional advertising, right? Like, you know, like on a billboard or on TV, like generally not targeted directly to me. Most people don't generally have a problem with it. Then people kind of have an invasive or a detailed view into your life, and they can tailor the advertisements directly to you that some people find somewhat off-putting. The example of search advertising, I think, is generally thought of as okay. If I go to Google, for example, and search for lawnmowers, and then like the first result is an ad for a lawnmower company. Well, that's kind of a contextual, that's kind of understandable. They know I'm looking for lawnmowers right now. It's that later, if like 2 weeks later, if you're on like a news site and then all of a sudden you get an ad for lawnmowers, I'm like, well, how do they know that I was interested in lawnmowers? Or you're shopping, the prototypical example is you're shopping for shoes, and then those shoes kind of follow you around the web and often different devices for the next several weeks, which I think, you know, people find somewhat off-putting. And, you know, in the case of finance, you know, they have really detailed information, or they can have very detailed information about how much money you have, what you're willing to pay for things, what you're interested in, your purchase history. And so that information could well be mined to then share with marketers about the sort of things that you're more likely to interact with when you're surfing on the web or using apps, or even increasingly on smart TVs as well. And some people might be totally fine with that. Some people are like, yeah, sure, show me things that are of interest to me. I think most people tend to find it invasive and abusive. And so I think that's why, I mean, and you know, that's honestly driven most of the privacy debate in the US and maybe overseas as well, with big tech companies having these detailed profiles about you to try to manipulate you to buy things. I don't really think it has been a huge issue in the fintech space yet. I don't think they're necessarily mining all this data to sell to marketers. But we also don't know, because again, there isn't that level of transparency. There aren't those legal obligations where companies are prohibited from doing it or disclosing it or being more clear about it. And so I think that is some hesitancy that some consumers have about giving, you know, these startups, who knows whether they're trustworthy or not, access to such detailed and personal information.
Well, thanks for that, Justin. And I just sort of put, following up, we do have a question on how consumer advocates and regulators can help mitigate. I'm going to come to this question at the end, because I know this is something that we kind of prepared for and we've got some ideas on. But just taking another question from Shah, what would make it easy for fintech companies to systemize consumer protection? So, Arisha, I didn't know if you wanted to respond to that question.
Sorry, I think I was, you wanted me to respond to the question?
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry, there's a question in the chat, which is, what would make it easy for
people? Oh, okay. All right. Sorry, Ben. I think what would make it easy, a mandate from the top always makes it very easy to systemize any sort of consumer protections. The recent EU Data Act, right? It just said manufacturers have to have their, whatever they are developing, it has to be in a certain manner where the data is easily accessible by the user and the manufacturer. So if the regulator is saying that, the government is saying that, it's very easy for the company to go ahead and do it. Aside from that, I think the general environment currently where there is definitely more awareness of data protection and how we can use data to drive value for everyone. I see a lot of that conversation happening. And because of that, there's a lot of innovation in the space, right? There are people who want to be able to monetize that opportunity as well while providing a solution that's kind of beneficial and that kind of adheres to all these system protections. That would be my two cents on that question.
Thanks, Arushi, that's great. And so, I mean, I think if we kind of come towards sort of thinking about wrapping up, we've got the last 10 minutes. Data sharing sort of, it feels quite mindful of data protection laws to take on board and then also sort of thinking about the financial context and then things like APIs and technology stacks, you know, it's quite challenging, isn't it? So I just wondered if we could perhaps answer this question we've got here and asymmetry of these new fintech companies, particularly around things like terms and conditions. And I've got some thoughts on some other work that I'm involved with at a company called Amplify Global, but I'll come to that last. But I don't know, Duncan, do you want to just kick us off?
Sorry, Faith, I missed the first part of that.
Oh, I was just saying it would be great if you were able to answer the question in the chat about how consumer advocates and regulators can help mitigate and reduce the power asymmetry. So how can consumer organisations help create more consumer-friendly, open finance ecosystems?
I think standardizing an approach and making sure a lot of companies do it in the same manner. I think one thing that is important when it comes to it is trust. And actually, fintechs are there to help the consumers, and they do that for a long time. But whenever the consumer thinks that they've used the service or they're not getting the benefit from it, it's so important to have that ability to be forgotten and to have the data sort of deleted and removed from that organization. And I think that that two-way conversation is you're giving consent to use the data, but at the same time you're receiving that benefit. And then if that stops at all, that ability to sort of stop and remove the data is really important. Coming back to the question specifically, how can regulators help reduce the power asymmetry? Again, I think it is dictating those standardized terms and helping fintechs have that level playing field is the main thing.
That's great. And moving to Benny, what are your thoughts on this question? How can we empower?
I think on the consumer organization, actually, I just want to mix up the question a bit, if that's okay. I was quite intrigued by the question on what can fintech providers themselves do, and maybe then kind of address what is it that consumer organizations can do. Fintech providers themselves, I suppose, Duncan makes a great point on trust, and we really think that the gap between access and usage is that of trust, right? If I'm able to trust a service, then if it's available to me, I'd definitely take it up. And I think in India, we're finding a few ingredients of that trust. We think that an effective grievance redressal mechanism is a must. And our work on the field is finding that even though, the transaction itself might be digitized, the grievance redress mechanism may not be the top priority for a provider, and therefore it kind of often gets overlooked. And the grievance redress process is often onerous, lengthy, long turnaround times, which is kind of a huge cost on those who already are kind of, you know, short of resources. And we found that to be kind of a factor that dissuades people from digital financial services generally, because there is no kind of ability to hold someone on the hook right away. There is no physical interface, touch point, so on and so forth. So I think grievance redress would be important. Second, what Duncan says, and we are finding in our work that a lot of the innovations around us are smartphone first, and there is still a lot of population that is still on feature phones and don't have smartphones, right? And we really need to kind of design for that group if we want to realize financial inclusion via digital. So that's the second kind of thing. And the third kind of thing is just data protection. I mean, sometimes the gap is, sometimes it's a bit of a gray zone, and it's hard for providers to understand what is right and what is wrong, and that's completely appreciated. But sometimes the difference is not so much, right? So for instance, once I have deleted the app, why are there, you know, things in the SDK that are still collecting data from my phone? I mean, that's a clear signal of end of relationship. So why would you still continue to track the consumer or not delete their data? Like, those kinds of hygiene points are kind of important when it comes to fintech. And very quickly on what regulators can do, I've touched it in the past. There is room for delegated regulation, but also RegTech. One thing that we have to understand is that risk proportionate RegTech is important, because we don't want to regulate fintechs for risks that they don't create, right? That's expensive, that's jarring, and that stifles innovation. So you really only want to regulate them for the risks that they create, and you want to do it in a way that is as nimble as their operations. It's impossible to think that there'd be a paper-based filing for an organization that has gone completely tech end-to-end, right? So I think there is that bit of learning curve that regulators are also finding themselves at, that how do you be as clever and as swift in regulation as the products themselves are?
Thanks very much, Benny. That's great. So we've got just 5 minutes left. So I thought it'd be useful just for perhaps Justin and Arush, who haven't managed to get to on this question, just to perhaps let us know really what your thoughts on what from today's panel do you most want to convey to our audience? What's the thing that you'd most like them to take away? So maybe Justin, then Arush, and I'll do a quick follow-up.
And so I mean, I feel like I've been like the Debbie Downer of this panel and expressing concerns and I think real fears, but I do think that it's also very promising technology too. I also recently refinanced a mortgage. I used a fintech startup. I think because of it, I probably had a better experience. I was able to access better rates, and I think there are very real benefits to consumers to having this level of competition. And then kind of going back to the other question, I think, you know, it's incumbent upon civil society organizations to try to shine sunlight on some of these behaviors and these companies to help educate consumers. You know, not all the burden should be on consumers, but I think they should be relatively as empowered as they can be to make a lot of the choices for themselves. So, you know, I think there are risks here. I talked about, ads is one thing, but there's also, this alternative scoring models where companies want access to all of your like personal information and social media and emails. And there's, again, invasive issues there. Maybe the benefits aren't worth it. There are potential for discrimination, right? Discrimination laws that may be evaded because companies are using algorithmic processing. So, we didn't talk about it very much, but price discrimination is a concern. If companies have access to all your information, they know how much you're willing to pay for services. I think more companies will have we will be able to extract relatively more value from consumers, and we will lose out. So a lot of issues need to be addressed over time, but I think real benefits too. So I think more sunlight, more transparency, and probably a little more rules for the road too.
Cool, thank you. And Arush, a quick final statement to finish us off, and I think that I will then have to call us to a close promptly.
Sure. I think just a kind of a reiteration of everything that's been said. I mean, with open finance, what we are finding, the power and control of data, which is, again, data itself is emerging as a very important resource, right? It will increasingly lie with the individual. So as individuals, as fintech providers, as legacy institutions, I think we all have to be very consciously more informed, a lot more aware, and a lot more responsible in how we harness this opportunity for the common good.
Thank you so much, Arush, for being so so succinct. And I think that's just it, isn't it? We've heard a lot about the opportunities. Data offers so much opportunity, but also the risks as well, which Justin has helped to highlight. I think for organisations looking at this, it does take a little bit of effort. It does take a little bit of focus. But actually, it's worth it because finance is becoming ever more data-driven, and it's really important that we look for ways to unlock the innovation and empower consumers, but also make sure that their data is protected and remains private. So I just want to say a big thank you for our panelists today. Thank you. And thanks for attending, everybody who arrived to attending. Sorry, the screen flickered. It was very exciting, but please do follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. And obviously there are sessions happening later today. Thank you for your questions, and thanks to everybody who contributed. We really appreciate the interaction. So thank you, everybody.